Literacy is dead. At least that's what a lot of people are saying. We don't think it's true. We do, however, think literacy is about to look different, a lot different. For many people, the words the end signify either satisfaction or sorrow. What happens after the end? How do words become catalysts for progress and advancement?
Join us today for The Afterword, a conversation about the future of words. Hi, I'm Amy Boland, literacy specialist, writer, and college instructor.
And I'm Holland Webb, a full-time writer and editor. And this is The Afterword. You know how Wall Street is teaching brokers to buy and sell stocks better? Board games.
Board games are really trendy.
Video games are what people think about, but the sale of board games in the U.S. grew by 28% between the spring of 2016 and the spring of 2017, and revenues are expected to continue to rise at that rate until the 2020s. Part of that's because more than 5,000 new board games each year get introduced to the market.
Some people are actually saying we are living in the golden age of board games.
Why?
Well, come on, Holland. I mean, games are fun and engaging, certainly more fun than most things we call work or school. Games are the optimal human experience, and they engage the mind into a powerful state of flow that most teachers and parents only wish for.
So to talk about that, we've brought together two game designers, writers, and educators, Dan and Connie Kazmaier and James Hannibal.
Daniel and Connie are the board game designers for Chai, an immersive tea board game that launched on Kickstarter in 2018. Prior to designing Chai, Daniel's first board game was back in grade 3 when he made a Hex Movement Hobbit game. Then he joined the competitive chess world in junior high, and he has been playing for about 15 plus years. Connie is a junior high special education teacher who is passionate about making learning engaging and fun. Aside from teaching, she also loves photography, graphic design, travel, and laughing at a good show on Netflix. Daniel and Connie join us tonight, and they have been married for 3 years. They live in Calgary, Canada, close to the Rocky Mountains.
And James Hannibal is the award-winning author of Section 13 Mysteries for Kids, and he was just telling me before we got started that he is also a board game designer and has a really interesting story about that. So, welcome, guys.
So before we get started into the thick of things, we would like you to tell us a little bit about yourselves and how did you get into the game design and writing world? And so, Connie, how did you get started?
So I am a junior high teacher, as you said, and one of the things I realized is kids really don't love literacy sometimes. A lot of my kids who are behind in their reading levels, they see literacy as something that they failed at before. Just something that they don't innately love. And so games are a great way of getting kids to talk to each other, to engage in problem solving, and generating that language with each other.
Wonderful. And how about you, Dan?
Yeah, I guess we've all enjoyed playing games growing up, whether it's Risk or Monopoly or, you know, Bridge, something like that. So we've really just enjoyed figuring out how board games and reality and imagination kind of meshed together. You mentioned that, I guess, board games are some kind of heightened human reality or enjoyment and experience. And I think for us, it's kind of an art form as well, where you're creating not only literacy and comprehension, but a whole unique world within where you have to engage and immerse yourself into the story. It's a little bit different than a solo game where you might be playing a video game, but here it's with real people, and that interaction can bring things alive.
I think the phrase that we used was the optimal human experience. James, how did you get into game design?
Well, it is a very interesting story, and I won't take too much time with it, but I've always loved creating adventures, telling stories, even when I was a kid. And the game that engaged me most as a kid was a Christian scripture application game called Dragon Raid. It was a fantasy game that immersed you in the story, kind of like a role-playing game. Grown up with kids getting to the teen years of my own, I went looking for that game, and I connected with the original creator, Dick Wolfe. And through my novels, my other publications, and some writing I did for Dick, we developed a relationship, and Dick is now focusing on a last year's project called Heaven Beckons, now in his 70s. And so he wanted to pass Dragon Raid on to me, and so in June I took over the fantasy world. And it has so much potential. And so we're turning it into a series of stories, a series of games on multiple levels, but all based on immersing the player into a story, because that's where the most engagement takes place. That's where all the learning takes place.
That word immersion is key, I think.
Absolutely.
I actually got interested in the whole idea of games because one of my clients is a board game designer in his spare time, and he was talking about it with great enthusiasm. And it had never occurred to me that somebody designed these games. I guess I thought they just appeared on the shelves at the store. Let's just go back to something really fundamental. What are the basic elements of a game, Connie?
I think a game really needs to challenge the brain to think differently from multiple angles and to solve a problem. So this is kind of the mechanism of a game. We also talked about how theme is a super important, but yet at the same time, the basic element is that puzzle or the mechanism, the problem that needs to be solved.
Is there anything you would add to that, James?
No, exactly what you said. The fundamental element of game design is creating the problem for the player to solve, just like in writing, how you create the problem for your hero to solve. And whether that problem is, you know, how many checkers I have to jump over to defeat my opponent, or that problem is how do I attain the sword and then return to the service and defeat the dragon, it's the same. You're creating a problem for your players to solve.
Fascinating.
You kind of alluded to this. How do you use those elements of game design when you're writing a novel?
I do teach story creation. And one of the things I'm trying to help the students do is not be afraid of creating stories. Because the teacher says, write me a story. And the kids go, okay, I have an idea. But how does that idea become a full-fledged story? And the really basic answer is identifying your hero and then creating that problem for your hero to solve. Just like it's the fundamental of game design, it's the fundamental of story creation, and you add challenges in. Like a game designer, you want to add good challenges to your game so that your players don't accomplish the goal too easily. And you mentioned never thinking about the people who designed the game, and I was sort of in the same boat, but months ago when I started working in game design, I realized one of the games we're developing has multiple games on a couple of different sides of the board, and it goes from simple to very complex. Even the simplest game, which is just a movement and dice rolling game, you can't imagine the math I had to go through with others in order to make the game achievable for all four players, equally achievable for all four players.
Dan, I just feel like you want to jump in.
My undergrad was in literacy, and primarily just historic English literature from Chaucer to Shakespeare. So maybe in game design, you have a climax or these aha moments that you want to recreate. A lot of the bigger game boxes, whether it's digital or, you know, in a physical form of a game, people are looking for those moments that are memorable. And you're creating that together with other people. So I think when it comes into creating an element where you're trying to build that excitement, you have to kind of take away different barriers of entry for either the person playing a game or a person reading a book. So in a setting, you might have, you know, introducing characters and whatnot, but then you're also deconstructing people's anxiety to make them feel at home. So that creates a place for them to engage into the story. So there's always different little creative tools you can use to engage people that way.
That's interesting. You said removing barriers to entry, and James was just saying you create barriers to success, right? Remove the barriers to entering the game, but then create a series of barriers that prevent the player from succeeding too easily.
You're creating accessible challenges in a way. Mm. A puzzle would be a simple form of that.
That's amazing. I love this idea that we think of barriers oftentimes as a negative, but then barriers also can give enough of a stress to entice. You know, and I think that's one of the things I'm hearing you all say in one of the basic elements of a game. It's, you know, we want to give people a foot in to whatever it might be, problem solving, math, literacy, but we also want to break down a barrier in order to give them a foot in the door. And so I love that we can use these words on both ends of the scale here a little bit. One of the things that we are going to throw in here is Holland has a little bit of history because, Dan, you mentioned something about your background in Chaucer and some of those old literary works, but we're not sure you all maybe have heard about some of the history of board games.
What we found, and you may know this, you may correct us if we found false information, but from what we were able to learn, the world's oldest board game was founded in the pre-dynastic and first dynasty burials of Egypt between 3500 and 3100 BC. It was called Sinnet and was pictured in a fresco found in a tomb between 3300 and 2700 BC. So people have been playing board games for a really long time.
And I think as we think about the history of board games, one of the things we want to ask you is you have brought a story element into creating your games. Can you give us some of the highlights of the story behind some of the games you've created? Let's ask James first. Give us a background a little bit about the story you use to create your game.
Well, and interestingly, I mean, I didn't create the original story. Dick Wolf created the story, and he's given me, he's handed this over me and entrusted me to expand the world. And so we're actually developing the origin story online with reader participation right now. I think it was Pursuit Magazine is publishing once a month a chapter, and we're, like a game, we're trying to get reader engagement. So the readers actually choose from a multiple choice which direction the hero will take next, and then I write the next chapter for the next month. But this is a fantasy world. It's its own place called Talania that has evil creatures, dragons and goblins and orcs, although they might take on a little bit of a different view from some of the traditional ways that we view those that go back to the sort of the Tolkien definition. But each of these creatures, this is a Christian game, and so each of these creatures represents some type of evil. And when you're engaging in the bigger role-playing game and the situational learning game, you're actually using a sort of a rucksack of tools, of scripture. One scripture might be a light, one scripture might be a sword that you're using in specific application against these fantasy creatures.
That's amazing, James. We will definitely want to get your information and be able to link that to our landing page. We'll get with you on that so that we can have that for other reader participation. Dan and Connie, talk to us a little about the story and how and why Chai.
Yeah, for us, we didn't really have a specific book or some kind of medium that, or media form rather, that inspired the ideas for us. We were just kind of figuring that there might be a niche in the board game world where they don't have a game that can engage family members at all different levels, but also include a theme that has brought people together. There's some really hard tea games and really easy ones for children, but nothing kind of family weight in that sense. So we kind of picked our favorite games and boiled a few mechanics from there and created a few more to add this kind of fruit salad of mechanisms that sort of created our game. It was more of the story that we were trying to create out of the game, if you will. So it's quite a community project where we've had over 1,000 unique people across the world try a free PDF download and offer feedback through a Google form. And yeah, we've created kind of different relationships in a community that has helped foster the game. But yeah, for us, maybe Flow by a famous Russian philosopher that's been pretty instrumental in making the game. I think he defines flow as like a deep sense of enjoyment, creativity, or involvement, kind of experience that is above a normal experience. And you're trying to create that kind of environment that will induce or create those spaces of flow. So games kind of give you that opportunity where you're kind of stepping outside of maybe the anxieties or joys of the world and then having this moment with a group of people and experiencing something new. And hopefully you experience something about yourself as well, whether that's a new discovery or a memory, something like that.
One thing that strikes me as I listen to you all is how collaborative the creative approach is. Unlike writing a novel where you create a story by yourself, you've both described a process that involves not just one or two other people, but a large number of people having input into the game. Is that typical in game design?
Yep. Usually in a lot of game design, there's the involvement of a lot of live play testers. So even here in Calgary, there's a Monday night play testing group in town where people would bring their prototypes in various stages. They just get the feedback and then they go back and tinker with it for another week and then bring it back the week after, right? So in a sense, play testing is that collaborative approach of having many different voices in this one game, making it flow a little bit better.
That is brilliant.
We would also call playtesting blind playtesting when it's overseas. So instead of having Connie or myself explain how the game works, they would just read a paragraph or two of how to play the game, which is really a test of literacy to see if we can properly communicate our own instructions to people without us being there. So that's been fascinating, just to see how people have interpreted just a few sentences in different ways than we anticipated, whether that's been good or bad, and it's helped us communicate for down the road when thousands more will be trying it.
What you've just described is every teacher's dream. You stand up in front of a group of people, and in a few brief sentences, you explain what you want. Everyone understands, and they enter a state of flow. Okay, sorry, James, keep going.
Well, so the blind playtesting that we're talking about is so important, not just for seeing whether the playtesters can understand what you're doing or what you're trying to communicate, but also in the game development process, you know, it's not a set in stone deal. Just like a novel, when you're going through drafts and you're going through test readers, a novel is a collaborative process. You're part of a critique group. And so, you know, you think of your playtesters as your critique group. And when they do that, they might make assumptions that seem natural to them. And that's something that's breaking down one of those barriers. So, you know, at times, maybe you don't want their assumption to take primacy because it's one of the challenges you're trying to present. But at others, if most of your playtesters are making an assumption on play that you didn't give to them, maybe that's something that you want to incorporate into the game.
Oh, wow. Again, what I keep going back to is this idea of problem solution. You talk about a good design in a game has a problem and a solution. And even in this collaborative environment, you've got a problem and you have some solutions. And you keep bringing that back into the process of designing these games and the qualities of a good game. So it really supports the learning process on both the designer and the player.
So what's something you learned in the process of designing your games?
One thing I learned, as I said earlier, was you can't just simply lay out a board of letters or colors and expect the movements to work. It takes work, and you can't expect your own preconceived notions about how a mechanic should work to be instantly communicated or to be second nature for someone else. And so that, you know, as an author, that really translates into writing. I want to create and forgive the terminology, but a hermeneutical path. I want to lead my reader to a message that I'm trying to create for them rather than just assume they're going to get it without a little bit of help.
I had not thought about it that way.
How about you, Dan and Connie?
Yeah, for us, it's probably about making good design very accessible. I was listening to one podcast with Connie, and the one designer who has 10 games you could find at a local store, they mentioned that if your game isn't being played by anyone, then it's not really a good game at all. Because, again, those entry points, you know, we'll talk about, is Monopoly a good game? And most are like, no, I hate it, but I love it, right? At the same time, if you're not making things that people can consume in a way, if they can't engage into the story or learn the rules quickly, let alone explain the rules to someone else, that becomes a huge barrier. Somewhere in the middle of our design, what we thought was an easier component or mechanism in Chai, we asked my mom, who is a non-gamer, to explain it back to us, and she just had a bewildered look on her face and, you know, profusely apologized that she couldn't explain the game her own son had made. And we all had a good laugh, and we went back to the drawing board and actually changed that aspect of the game, and she could easily understand it the next time and became quite familiar with the concept altogether. So, and for us, it's not only being accessible, but then consumable and reproducible in a teaching aspect of, can you explain this concept to someone else? And that would also go into the rule book that we were mentioning beforehand, where not only is it readable, but can someone comprehend it? And then from there, can they synergize? Can they create ideas, you know, decisions, and strategize as they play the game? The most horrible feeling when you're playing a game is realizing I understand how to play, but I don't know how I should be playing it. You kind of have this fog about you. And in literacy, I would experience the same if I read a PhD dissertation from a field I have no understanding or interest in, because there's a lot of words that are hitting me that I won't be able to comprehend.
That is an excellent point. And I love how you brought that back into this idea of accessibility and are people actually using it and can it be explained? And also the simplicity, I think, of games. And Holland and I were looking at some history. And when you mentioned about your mom not really being able to explain it back to you, it was very interesting that back in 1974, when Erno Rubik invented the Rubik's Cube, he stumped more than 350 million people around the world. But it was very interesting that it actually took him a full month to figure out the puzzle once he twisted the cube and realized he didn't know how to get the cubes realigned. So this idea of learning through maybe some difficulty or, oh, maybe this would work better. And James, I love how you aligned that also to when you're writing a draft. First one isn't always the best one, so we're going to have to go back and incorporate maybe a clearer expression in this game or in this part of the book. So that was excellent. I love that insight. I had never thought about that.
Join us next week for the conclusion of our conversation with Dan and Connie Kazmaier and James Hennibal on board games and literacy. You can find us on our website, theafterwardpodcast.com, or wherever you're listening right now.